Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. Tonight I want to talk about the topic of anatta. Anatta is a Pali Sanskrit word, A-N-A-T-T-A, anatta. And it's one of the kind of foundational teachings that the Buddha offered on how we can find freedom from suffering in our world. You know, anatta is a very challenging teaching to start to talk about. It's hard to get in the water and figure out the best way to begin. Because if we're not careful, it can sound philosophical and it can sound, ontological about whether we as people exist or not. Because the teaching, when translated, is called not self. Anatta, not self. And that's not what the Buddha was interested in, whether we as people exist or not. We obviously exist. Here we are in this room together. But really about how we hold and how we relate to this idea of the self, or the experience, rather, of the self. How do we hold, how do we relate to the experience of ourselves? So the first thing I want to talk about is just the importance of building a healthy sense of self in the world. This is fundamental for happiness and welfare. The happiness and well-being that we're looking for comes from constructing and creating a sense of self that we feel is, has purpose and meaning and connection. A sense of self that, is not fragile. And so, I want to start by talking a little bit about some of the, social learning theories, the psychosocial theories on how we construct our sense of self, how we make sense of ourself in the world. And one of the people I kind of want to nod to is a really interesting guy named Erik Erikson. He studied what he calls the psychosocial development of, our lifespan. How do we develop a sense of self in relation to others over the course of our lives? Erikson was a psychoanalyst, and he looked at how and really monitored and researched how people develop during different stages of their lives. And the first stage is very important, so I want to talk a little bit about this first stage, which also got expounded upon by two other kind of primary folks, one named John Bowlby and another named Mary Ainsworth, and looking at attachment, how we attach to our caregivers and how that's important for our sense of self. So the first stage of life is from zero, as he says, 0 to 1.5 years. And he calls it the trust versus mistrust stage of life.
This is Erik Erikson.
Erik Erikson, yep. And during this stage, the infant, us, born into the world, is uncertain about the world we live in. Some neuroscience researchers believe, we can't ask infants what they experience, but they believe that infants don't have a sense of boundary to their body, that they're this sensitive ball of nervous system. So imagine just, don't imagine too hard, but imagine if you didn't have any sense of boundary. You didn't know that I'm here and you're there, right? And so infants are very sensitive, and in this stage of life, we're uncertain about the safety of our world. To resolve our feelings of uncertainty, we look towards our primary caregivers, the people that are there around us for stability and for consistency and care. If we receive consistent care, predictable and reliable care, then we develop a sense of trust, which we carry into other relationships of our life. And then we start to feel more secure in trusting that people are reliable, consistent, and predictable. If the care that we receive is harsh or inconsistent, unpredictable or unreliable, then the infant will develop a sense of mistrust and will not have confidence in the world around them or in their own ability to influence events in their life. Self-doubt, ambivalence. And so this is a really fascinating, you know, kind of thing to reflect on for me. I'm a little bit of a nerd, so forgive me if you're not interested in this stuff. But I think it's fascinating because what this means to me is that our earliest interactions with people organize our sense of whether we feel like we can trust and have safety and stability in our world. And so our sense of self really is created through a relationship in the beginning. And the study, the research on this is extensive. You may have heard of some of John Bowlby's research on I think they call it the strange person, where they have kind of infants interact with people they don't know and have their caregiver present and then their caregiver absent, a variety of kind of scenarios. And they looked at these infants and how they developed attachment over the course of their life, and they found that if you developed an insecure attachment early on, there was a very high percentage of these same infants that had the same insecure attachment much later in their life. And so one of the things that I like to kind of just put out here as we talk about our sense of identity is that our internal working model, our understanding of ourself in the world, which constructs how we perceive, interpret, and relate to the world, is formed through mostly family experiences during infancy. And by mostly, I don't mean that it's not changeable. It is. And that it's not influenced by later things. It is. But this is like the foundation that we build on. And so to have secure attachment, it means that we must have safety. And safety to an infant means proximity, meaning that your caregiver is there. It means we must be seen. Being seen means literally having attunement, which is your caregiver is able to show up and to look you in the eye so you can see with your visual sense that someone else is there with you. That's how you start to develop the sense of boundary. Like I said earlier, if you have no sense of boundary, if you see your caregiver, they're there, they're around, you connect, you make eye contact, you sense someone is here. And then we must be soothed. Being soothed means, they call this marking, which is where a caregiver is able to mirror back the emotion you're experiencing, and then they flash, and they don't consciously do this. We're just kind of wired for it, which is the good news. I'll tell you other good news here in a little bit. So marking means that we're able to soothe emotions by seeing the emotion that our infant is experiencing, and we flash the nonverbal kind of response. You flash the emotion back to them. If a little kid falls down, you go, oh, and you scrunch your face up, right? Or a little kid's crying, you say, oh, why are you sad? Your voice, your tone of your voice mirrors theirs. And then what happens is you say, you're okay, and you mark the emotion, you show that you're not feeling the same way, right? So there's this sense of feeling like there's someone here to care for us in the emotion. They understand it, and they're not it. And then the fourth thing is to encourage, which is to encourage the, you know, infant to have some agency in self-regulating the emotion. You know, finding out ways to self-soothe. So the good news, like I said, is you don't have to know any of this. And I believe it was Winnicott, another attachment researcher, that said that in order to have a secure attachment, you have to have just what he calls a good enough caregiver. And I think a good enough caregiver is a caregiver that is able to do these things about 30% of the time. Not that important. But important. But, you know, this stuff functions kind of like a spectrum. So it's not like you're either have an insecure attachment or a secure attachment, either or. It's that we all experience varying degrees of our sense of trusting, you know, that there's safety, reliability, consistency in the world. And so as we go throughout life, this is the point, is that other experiences inform previous experiences. And in psychology, they might call this something like scaffolding, which is that your earliest experiences are impacted by later experiences. And so Erickson talks about another stage of development, one of my favorites, called identity versus role confusion from 12 to 18 years old. So I skipped ahead. And during this stage, adolescents search for a sense of self and personal identity through an intense exploration of personal values, beliefs, and goals. This is a major stage of development where the child has to learn the roles that he or she will occupy as an adult. It's during this stage that the adolescent will explore the possibility of different roles and begin to develop a sense of self, their own identity, separate from, you know, family values. So that's why teens like to rebel. And that's why teens like to go against whatever it seems to be that the family is for, the teens anti. And so that's very, you know, common. And it's a part of developing a sense of autonomy and freedom in the world. And just as kind of a tangent, it's kind of interesting to note that the major identities that we're trying to form during adolescence are our sense of role responsibility, which is what gives us purpose or what type of career or occupation or what do we want to become as a professional person, and also our sexual identity. And so the good news is that we, as we grow, as we move through the world, our brains develop, our brains gather more wisdom as we gather more data about the world, and we learn to integrate our sense of self. We learn how to find and explore new things, new connections, new values, all throughout our life, and to integrate them into early experiences. So they call these corrective experiences. You can have corrective experiences. And so where do we start? You know, how do we start to develop a sense of self today? You know, how do we start to kind of, build up self-esteem, self-worth, right? To put it simply, it starts with, I think, what I talked about a couple weeks ago, is just understanding first. It's kind of like a prerequisite to trying to get self-esteem and self-worth, is to know that there's like a hierarchy of needs, that there are certain things that need to get met in order to be able to start to develop a healthy ego, a healthy sense of who we are in the world. And so, you know, Maslow has this hierarchy of needs, the first being physiological, food, water, sleep, shelter. The second being safety, personal security, emotional security, financial security, health and well-being. And the third kind of level of need is social belonging, friendships, intimacy, and family. And then esteem, which is a sense of competence or self-confidence, independence and autonomy. And self-actualization, which is seeking happiness, you know, through spiritual development, through, you know, just the pursuit of happiness in our lives. And so I don't see these stages as like you go through one, you go through the second, you go through the third, you find your way to the top and you stay there, right? We all find ourselves kind of navigating different levels of, you know, security. And so it's something to know that if I don't have a sense of personal security or emotional security or even financial security, it's going to be maybe harder to build, you know, intimacy and relationships because those other things are impacting my ability to do that. And so what the Buddha said is to start by looking at how to function in the world. And he calls this sila, which is the development of practicing ethics, you know, living with integrity, having accountability. He calls this sangha, which is what we are, this community of people that are interested in the pursuit of happiness. And that we, through, you know, community and through accountability and through living with intention and having integrity as, you know, an aim of our spiritual development, by starting with our behaviors, you know, we start to, as they say in AA, act our way into right thinking. We start to create safety through behavior. And this is so important. This is fundamental for happiness, is that, you know, I like to say that happiness is a collection of good habits. Our happiness is really not a place. It's a set of practices. It's a, you know, creating an environment of security, creating an environment of support, creating an environment of accountability, of people that push us to, you know, be our best selves, to hold us accountable when we're, you know, being manipulative and when we're rationalizing our behaviors, people that keep us in check by having bottom line behaviors and saying, all right, Andrew, this thing, you keep doing it, it doesn't work, need to do something else. You know, I need to practice renunciation, which is another principle that the Buddha talked about. It's a big part of sila, living with ethics and integrity, is letting go of what doesn't serve us. You know, and the Buddha said this is so important. This word nikama in Pali Sanskrit, I like to translate as not needing anything extra, not needing to get involved in the chaos of, you know, temporary, intense pleasures that don't satisfy long-term happiness.
And what is the word?
Say what?
What is that word?
Nikama. I'm horrible at spelling. I think it's N-E-K-K-A-M-A.
And is this more ego-driven, the things that we pursue at that time, or what you're talking about?
Uh-huh.
Because I just imagine that they would be fleeting, what the world tells us we need, but not necessarily what really feeds us.
Sure. Yeah. So this works in conjunction with mindfulness, right? Which is also having introspection and really learning how to watch our motivations and really start to practice what I just call living a contemplative life. The Buddha calls this anupassati, which is contemplation. Or to repeatedly look at, that's what it actually means, to repeatedly look at, is this happiness? Is it in this thing that I'm seeking and that I, this behavior, is it really making me happy or does it just make me feel good for a period of time? You know, and that, these are hard questions because the interesting thing about Buddhism is that there's no God watching over us necessarily, or maybe there is. The Buddha didn't talk about God. So he's basically saying you're accountable to yourself. He says the only thing you own are your actions. He said the beings are the owners of their actions, the heirs of their actions. They spring from their actions. In whatever way you act, that to that you will fall heir.
Say that again.
In any way you act, to that you will fall heir. So you will fall heir. You will be, creating the environment that you live in through your actions. And this isn't just through our physical behaviors, it's through our mental thoughts. You know, it's through our judgments and our comparisons and criticisms. So the good news here is that, the survival system of the brain is a little bit hot-wired. And so, we do already practice things that are for the benefit of our welfare. We have plenty of evidence of that. Just the fact that we're sitting in this room tonight, like something in us is interested in meditation or is interested in Buddhism or is interested in, living with spiritual practice in our lives. But we just got to watch out because we kind of fall into these habits. And so the best way to start is to look at changing the behaviors itself, to look at having some kind of support in looking at why we do the things we do. So as we get our most basic needs met, we start working on developing an integrated sense of self, which means we take care of a full spectrum of needs. So this will maybe help you to kind of think about what are the behaviors, what are the things we're practicing around. Physical needs, our health, emotional needs, intellectual, financial, spiritual, interpersonal. This is just one way of looking at the whole person. One of my friends, a fellow therapist, calls this the whole perspective. I really like that because when you meet with someone in therapy, it's easy to focus on the thing that they're talking about. It's easy to say, well, why are you here? Well, my relationship. And so it's easy to just focus on the relationship and forget about the physical health. The emotional needs. Well, what are your emotional needs in a relationship? Those are different for different people. What are your intellectual needs yourself? Are you learning? Are you studying? Are you passionate about things, hobbies? And, what are your financial needs? What are your spiritual needs? And then our interpersonal needs, which includes things like boundaries. How to live as an integrated person means understanding the sense of, our autonomy, our happiness depends upon how we relate to people, not the people themselves. And so some of us have more access to this power that I'm about to describe than others because society makes it that way. But the principle still important is that it's up to us to set boundaries. It's up to us to learn how to express needs. It's up to us to communicate what's working and not working for us. And like I said, different people have different access to that ability. That's important. But this is part of living as an integrated person, is just kind of understanding, that these are territories, are physical, emotional, intellectual, financial, spiritual, interpersonal. These are territories we want to pay attention to and kind of clean them up. Now, here's where I'm kind of like going to start heading in the other direction. One thing I want to say is that cultivating a healthy sense of self is essential for our well-being, but we need to be flexible in how we do that. Sometimes we try to improve ourselves, and there's this, it comes from this place of just feeling like, we're not doing enough. We're never doing enough. And so we live in a kind of culture where we're like born into this whole system of self-improvement. And it's kind of like, get your ass out of bed earlier, meditate more, exercise better, have a better diet. There's all this kind of like, striving around creating a sense of self.
People are always trying to sell you ideas all the time.
Say what?
People are trying to sell us ideas all the time.
Selling us ideas?
Yeah,
for sure. Right? It's like, what's the next thing that's going to be, you know, what's the next diet that's going to come along? I was just thinking about, like, there was Atkins, and then there was the South Beach diet, and then there's... And these things in and of themselves, for some of us, you know, are helpful. But it's our relationship. It's about how we relate to, you know, our improvement. When it comes from a place of, I'm not whole, I'm not good enough as I am, and I need to be better, and I need to work harder, and I need to be perfect. You know, it kind of comes from this, you know, core, like, shame, almost.
It's American.
It's very American. It's American as apple pie, right? Shame.
You're hungry, and you're just wanting more and more and more.
Uh-huh.
And you want to be happy.
That's right.
It's the promise of what we hope to have.
Right. And so we have to look kind of more, just a little bit more behind the curtain of our motivations. And we need to be flexible, and this is really what I want to kind of talk a little bit about, and then we'll open it up. We need to be flexible in the ways we think about ourselves, our self-view. And so this is really what the Buddha's talking about when he talks about anatta, which is how do we view ourselves, our sense of identity? The Buddha is saying that the self, what we think of as who we are, is not a noun, it's a verb. This is probably the most important thing I can say around anatta, and it's okay if that doesn't make sense, but it's an important thing to reflect on. What he's saying is who you are is not a, you know, permanent entity, but that you're a being, which is an interesting word, actually, if you think about it. Being has a verb kind of component to it. So you are something that is being affected and impacted by moments and moments and moments of experience. So you are not a thing, you're a verb. You're transforming, you're changing. So when we fix ourselves to an identity, we suffer because we think I am this being, this person, and that person is who I am. That's at my core. And then when that changes, when that role or that experience or that whatever changes, we suffer. And so he's not saying don't be anyone. That's a very problematic view of anatta. Actually, the Buddha specifically said he doesn't teach no self. He teaches not self, which is there's nothing that we're experiencing in this moment that is wholly who we are. All of it is a part of who we are. Our sights, our smells, our tastes, our sounds, our feelings, our thoughts. You know, this is the... Our thoughts are a big one, too. Our thoughts have memories, and, you know, we have volition, which is the ability to do what we think about doing. You know, so who we are is a dynamic process. When we fix our sense of identity too strongly to people, places, things, and even worldviews and opinions, we tend to suffer. A really easy example of this is what I call attachment to roles. Attachment to roles, just to kind of give some context, you know, we make sense of our world by identifying with roles, occupations, relationships, political and social stances, you know, our views,
genders,
all of these things. We make sense of the world through, you know, constructing roles. And we need roles. We need roles because roles help us to feel safe. Like I said earlier, just like you need a caregiver and some consistency and someone to show up. We need, this is what in Zen Buddhism they called form. You need form. We have our roles in culture, like I'm white. Someone's a female, a person of color, queer, American, liberal, conservative, immigrant, educated, progressive, upper class, environmentalist, self in society, self in culture, self roles. We have roles in community. You know, like I'm in a 12-step community. I'm a recovering addict. In those rooms, I say, I'm Andrew, I'm an addict. Right? It's part of my role in there. I'm a Buddhist. You could be a Christian, a felon, a gang member. You know, we can have membership with different organizations and groups as your community roles. We have, especially big time in our culture, occupational roles. When you sit on an airplane and someone sits next to you, one of the first things they want to know is, what do you do? And how do we interpret that? Well, for money. Right? It'd be weird to say, well, I just sit here and breathe and think and feel. What do you do? Probably get a weird response. We have ourself and family. These are other really big roles. I'm a mother, I'm a father, grandparent, daughter. I was adopted, I'm an uncle, I have a niece. You know, self and relationship. I'm a husband, I'm married, I'm single, I'm divorced, I'm widowed. So these are all roles. These are all, you know, how we make sense of our identity. And these things are real. These are very real. Very important to know these are real. They call this the conventional world. This is the material world we live in. These are roles, and we don't want to abandon these roles. We want to know that they exist, and we want to know, you know, how they relate to others, other roles. But what we want to look at is how these roles create identification, which is this sense of kind of solidifying around and clinging to the roles. Yeah, attachment to identity and self-worth, right? How we derive our worth from.
But that's not real. That's not real, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying it is real. And here, let's see if it kind of sorts itself out. Let me give an example first. One of the examples is, you know, like what they call the empty nest syndrome. So if a big part of your identity is to be a mother to a kid, or a father to a kid. Fathers can empty nest too. And then your kids grow up and they go through their own adolescent exploration and they get their own friends and they're not so lovey and sweet and dependent on you. And then they move to a different state and pursue their dreams. There can be this sense of, you know, a lot of our identity was built up around that experience. You know, and when that experience changes, doesn't end, but changes, when our identities, our roles change, we have a hard time. We call this identity crisis. And so here's what I want to say about this. I'm not saying don't have identities. I'm saying that, and I think the Buddha's saying that, we want to really understand that this is a thing. That means that when our roles change, we have a hard time feeling a sense of purpose and meaning and fulfillment that will be affected by those things. When you move, right? We, you know, for folks that have moved to different cities, that's a really hard thing because our sense of who we are and our places that we visited, those things change. And so, in the Buddha's words, we want to really watch out for and just understand how our identities change. And we also want to watch out for this other thing he calls bhava tanha, which is craving to become. And craving to become is this kind of habit to want to be someone, someplace, in some position other than what we are. It's different than having aspirations and goals. Because craving is a demanding the satisfaction of being someone or something or in some position different than we are. So it has this, you know, thirst to it.
Different from what we are or where we are.
Different from what or where we are. Craving, demanding, wanting to be in some position, some place, some identity different than where we are. Or different than what we think
where
we are.
Psychically, not logistically.
Means logistically, like the place, mm-hmm. I want to be, you know, in a more rural, you know, whatever. I don't have the money to buy a house. I want to be there. I want to be... So it's a desire, Ajahn Sachito says, that's never satisfied because it shifts from one emotional need to the next, from one sense of achievement to another goal. It's a desire that comes from a black hole of need. And so I call this all the time in groups that I teach, I call it the I'd rather be's or the if only's. So I'd rather be somewhere else. I'd rather be with someone else. I'd rather be doing something else. If only I had a better partner. If only I wasn't single. If only I was single. If only I, you know, had a better job. If only I didn't have to work so much. If only I, you know, the mind has this dancing illusion that once we become the person we need to be, then we'll be happy. And I've never found that person.
Because it's always over there.
It's always over there.
Wagner wrote a great line in Search for Science and Intelligent Life. Uh-huh. All my life I wanted to be somebody. Now I realize I should have been more specific.
Right. I love that. Yeah.
It reminds me also, I used to have bulimia, and it's just this, it's this endless wanting, and it's almost like the wanting is a drug itself.
That's right.
It's the desire for the need for more and more and more and more. And then, because it doesn't satisfy, you empty yourself.
That's right. So the Buddha calls this samsara, which is perpetual wandering.
Which is hell.
It's hell. And it's interesting in Buddhist cosmology, which you don't have to believe in this, it's just an interesting thing, that rebirth, being born again and again and again, is a psychological habit, like you're describing. And so from like the Buddhist cosmology perspective, being born again into the world is actually... suffering, because we get caught in this cycle of trying to satisfy this becoming, this endless becoming.
That's what I'm a singer-songwriter. That's the title of my album.
Endless Becoming?
No, Becoming.
Becoming.
But it was about getting free from a lot of the stuff.
Right. Yeah.
How do you separate that from your own evolutions?
Tell me more. Well, let me read a couple things and let's come back to that. Don't forget your thought here. Because then I want to open it up, because it sounds like a good time to open it up. So the flip side of the craving to become is what's called vibhava tanha, which is craving for non-existence, which is to craving to get rid of some part or all of an experience or ourselves. So it's kind of self-denial, not wanting to be who we are. You know, this is like self-hatred, self-criticism, self-judgment. A lot of this shows up in what Brené Brown calls, well, we call core shame, but she calls it the inner hustler, and this is one of my favorite quotes. She said, "Of no fault of our own, the mind often attempts to keep us safe by becoming overly concerned with our status and about what people think, about always being better than, always being right. I think of this part of my mind as my inner hustler. It always tells me to compare, prove, please, perfect, outperform, and compete. The inner hustler has a shame-based fear of being ordinary, of not being important. The hustler has very little tolerance for discomfort and self-reflection and rarely challenges its own self-made stories." And this is interesting. She says, without active awareness, mindfulness, the mind doesn't take responsibility for its stories, nor does it have any interest in writing new endings to them. It denies emotion, hates curiosity, and if unattended, the mind will quickly use its own stories as armor and alibi, avoiding truth and vulnerability are critical parts of the hustle. She said, avoiding truth and vulnerability are critical parts of the hustle. So the truth is that, you know, we're all just trying to get along in this world. And we do need to become things. We do need identities and roles. It's just about how we relate to and hold those roles. It's about watching the mind's endless becoming, to try to be who we'd rather be, or if only we had the life that we could imagine. Or trying to get rid of some part of ourselves that's wrong, that's unworthy, that's shameful. And the Buddha taught this, what he calls the middle path, between the extremes of becoming and not becoming, and being, right? This is what mindfulness is all about. It's just being. Being and being present and being aware and watching the mind. Like I said in the meditation tonight, babysitting the mind, being kind and gentle and forgiving and compassionate, because the mind's just trying to be someone and trying to, you know, be the one that can finally be loved. And there's a really great quote from meditation teacher, one of my predecessors that taught me a lot. His name's Vinny Ferraro. He says that there are only two parts of ourselves, what's loved and what's longing to be loved. And we, you know, we think we have to be someone first. And we think we have to, you know, I don't know, find it out here. And the Buddha says that everything you need, you know, to find love, to, you know, find fulfillment, is already inside of you.